It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh's local music scene has been growing both in numbers and in talent over the last few decades, largely through live performances in the city's various venues. But now there's a new way to discover local music electronically. Launching on Friday, Stax is Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh's ongoing digital collection of our region's vital and evolving music scene. It gives fans of local music access to sounds from artists throughout the area using only a library card. Toby Greenwald is the Director of Digital Strategy for the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh and joins us today. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Toby, there are so many different ways to stream music online. Apple Music, Spotify, SoundCloud. What makes Stax different from those widely used services?
For us, it's the local focus, and I think that's twofold. One, we want to highlight and elevate artists, give people a one-stop place to find local artists. But the other part is we want to make sure that the performers themselves are adequately rewarded for their work, whether through exposure or through compensation.
So there is the opportunity, or will they automatically be compensated?
We sign a license agreement with them, and so they're paid for the work that we put up on the site.
Okay. Where can we find Stax?
So Stax is available at stax.carnegielibrary.org, or you can connect to it through our website, carnegielibrary.org.
The site is scheduled to be up and running Friday, but when did the idea sort of start to percolate, and how long has it been building this archive?
Mm-hmm. Well, the big question we've had is at the library is, what do people do with our resources? A few years ago, we launched a collection of musical instruments that people could circulate, and we heard in kind of a word-of-mouth fashion that people were starting to record things with it, but we never really saw the direct fruits of their labor.
Right.
And this gave us a chance to really kind of put that front and center and hopefully create kind of a virtuous cycle.
You're working on this with a local startup called Rabble to mm-hmm. develop the software. So what role are they playing in this overall catalog of music?
So Rabble has really helped us kind of put the process on rails. They helped us build they provide the software framework. So it's a series of templates through which all that makes it sound good and look pretty. But then they also help us with the legal framework for working with artists and creating license agreements and so on.
Platforms similar to Stax are in libraries in places like Minneapolis and Seattle, for example. Did you check them out before getting ready to launch Stax here at the Carnegie Library in Pittsburgh?
Absolutely. Veering into uncharted territory as we're doing, we want to make sure that we do some due diligence. And so seeing what they did in Minneapolis and Portland and Seattle and these other cities really gave us a nice basis of comparison. And seeing how it benefited both the library and the artists really stood out and helped us help convince us to go forward with the project.
How long they've been around in general, would you say?
It's all together. It's been about 4 or 5 years.
Oh, okay, so there is sort of a track record you can check out for what they've done.
Absolutely, and mm-hmm. we've seen how their collections have not only had immediate success, but they've been able to grow and develop over time. And we hope to do the same thing.
All right. So to kick off, how many artists are featured? Do we know their names?
Absolutely. There's 40 artists featured, and it represents a pretty diverse selection of Pittsburgh's music scene, both in terms of the musicians themselves and in the musical styles that are represented.
Are we talking about individual artists, bands, both?
It's kind of all of the above. And mm-hmm. we've got some folks. We've got Pittsburgh mainstays, bands like, or people like Slim Forsyth and bands like Come Holy Spirit. We've got some more experimental artists like Arsonist, who does a lot of really really interesting soundscapes backed with violin. We've got a lot of great hip-hop artists, folks like Pyro and BB Guns and Brittany Chantel.
Mm-hmm.
It really runs the gamut.
So you do, obviously, from those examples, have a variety of genres and styles.
We sure do. And I think it's important because Pittsburgh's music scene is so diverse that we try to present as wide a sampling as we can.
Yeah, you want to reflect that diversity in the music in your offerings.
Absolutely.
So what was the criteria? What is the criteria for the music to be eligible to be part of Stax?
At the base level, we asked for a couple of things. One is that the artists are local. They either live or perform in the area. The other part is that at least a portion of the music that they're offering to us was released in the last 5 years. We want this to be kind of a document of the scene as it currently exists. Mm-hmm. And so by putting those in place, we're able to make sure it stays current and vital.
Do you have strict definition of the area?
We mainly say Pittsburgh, Allegheny County, Mon Valley, but the we can be flexible with that, provided that we can see the connection through, you know, looking at their tour listings or looking at what other connection they've had with the city.
I want to talk a little bit more about the selection process. You used a group of curators to decide which songs, what music would be added to the archive. So how did you select the selectors?
Well, our goal was to make sure that we had a diverse set of musicians. And to meet that end, we wanted to make sure that our jury pool met the same sort of, reflected that same level of diversity. So we looked for people who had strong connections with the local music scene, both in terms of, you know, who they were and representing different levels of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked to folks like Jim Cunningham from WQED. We talked to folks like Jaquaya May, who is part of the One Hood Media Hip Hop Collective.
Right.
We've talked to some other folks, James Armstead Brown, who's a music educator with the YMCA. Mary Tremonti, who does a lot of DJ work and has been involved with Pittsburgh Lady Fest. So it's really helped us to kind of better understand it from the level of people who've been directly involved.
Yeah, a nice variety of curators to reflect your nice variety of performers.
Absolutely. Yeah, and then we have some folks on staff who've helped us with the process as well.
I bet you a lot of people wanted to get involved in it. Can I help?
It was, yeah.
So since there are so many artists and bands from around the city, from the area, trying to be heard, was getting submissions a challenge or not so much?
The hard part was really winnowing it down. We originally said that we were going to take about 30 to 35 submissions the first time. We received 160 submissions the first time around. So we pulled some strings, got a little extra funds to take in extra artists, and ended up with 40 as a nice round number.
Right. So how were they able to submit, and will they be able to submit in the future?
Absolutely. Submissions are all done through the website. There's a form when the submission window's open where you put in some biographical information about yourself. You can then upload a track, and then that goes into our back end so the jury can help rate and select it. Our next submission period, we hope to do this about twice a year. The next one we're hoping to do in early April.
People have been going to the library to find music for decades, whether it's vinyl, cassettes, even CDs. Since Stax is a digital archive, they don't have to go to the library, I assume?
That's correct. We certainly would welcome you to come visit, but you can access it anywhere you have an internet connection.
And you just need a library card?
Well, it's actually open to anybody.
Okay.
To stream the music. So you can go visit each artist profile, listen to the tracks online through the embedded player. But if you'd like to download the music and keep a copy for yourself, you enter your library card and it'll allow you to download work.
Stax launches Friday. You mentioned 40 musicians, performers. Are you looking to grow that over the years? How is this going to evolve?
Yes, absolutely. Well, we'll swap out our judges over time depending on what the needs of our what types of musical styles we'd like to see. We'll do a call for submissions twice a year. Like I said, the next one will be in April. We'll probably do another one in September, and then do that on a rolling basis. So that way it will continue to grow and evolve, and those little snapshots of the immediate music scene will change over time.
Okay. And so will it keep expanding, or are you swapping out?
So our current license is a perpetual license.
All right.
So artists are encouraged to keep their stuff in our collection for as long as possible, depending on, you know, if somebody decides to take their music elsewhere, we can swap things out. But you know, we'd like to see, we'd like this collection to live on and grow for as long as it possibly can.
And Toby, again, how can people check out Stax?
It's simple. All you need to do is point your web browser to stax.carnegielibrary.org.
Toby Greenwald is the Director of Digital Strategy for the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you. It's been great to be here.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
WYEP celebrates Black History Month with a musical reflection. People Get Ready.
People get ready. There's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage. You just get on board.
Written by Curtis Mayfield in 1964, the gospel-inspired song became a hit for his group, The Impressions, the next year.
Don't need no ticket. You just thank the
The song would go on to be a civil rights anthem, its use of train imagery referencing the Underground Railroad and a path to freedom. Martin Luther King Jr. named it the unofficial song of the civil rights movement and would often play or have people sing the song at marches and rallies. Mayfield cited King's I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington as inspirations for writing the song.
There ain't no room for the hopeless sinner.
The song and its message has resonated since its debut, and it has multiple cover versions, including Aretha Franklin and the Blind Boys of Alabama.
There's a train coming. Don't need no baggage. You just get on.
Bob Marley even made his own interpretation of the song with his hit One Love.
As it was in the beginning,
one love.
So shall it be in the end.
For more audio celebrating Black History Month, listen to WYEP throughout February or go to WYEP.org/Black History Month.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at WESA.FM/Confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, arguments are presented in the 1937 case of the National Labor Relations Board v. Jones and Laughlin Steel Corporation. The company had recently fired 10 employees in Aliquippa who wanted to unionize. The landmark decision set a precedent for labor law, saying the steel giant could not discriminate against workers who tried to organize. J&L Steel also had to give the workers back pay. After the case, union membership flourished in Pittsburgh and around the country. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Ohio River provides drinking water for more than 5 million people. A multi-state commission charged with ensuring water quality in that river will consider whether to eliminate its pollution control standards February 14th. Thousands of people have expressed opposition. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that others say one reason to drop the standards is that some states never even adopted them.
This all started 5 years ago when Dayton Power and Light, along with a handful of energy companies, challenged the state of Ohio. They said the state permits could not use a standard set by the Ohio River Valley Sanitation Commission, known as ORSANCO, that limits the temperature of the company's waste discharges into the Ohio River. That's because the state had never officially adopted the ORSANCO standards into Ohio law, and the companies won.
It was a shock.
Tom Fitzgerald is an Orsenco commissioner. Each of the 8 Ohio River states has 2 or 3 commissioners on the board. I caught up with Fitzgerald by phone on his way to the Kentucky legislature, where he lobbies on environmental issues. On Orsenco, he's considered a federal commissioner.
Yeah, I'm one of the 3 federal commissioners that were appointed by President Obama. So I guess I'm a holdover.
Orsenco is a compact between the Ohio River states that dates back to 1948, before the Federal Clean Water Act, before states had their own water quality standards. Through the decades, the experts at Orsenco have created rules and standards for all kinds of discharges into the river, like specific limits on chemicals such as benzene and mercury to protect aquatic life and human health. What came to light in that 2014 case was that while some states in the compact, like Pennsylvania and Indiana, have adopted the Orsenco standards to protect water quality, others, like Ohio and Illinois, have not.
Your technical people and your commissioners have been approving these standards for decades. Are you now telling me that you believe that they're suitable and appropriate for the river, but you're not using them?
Fitzgerald says this disparity impacts water quality and creates an unfair playing field for industries in the different river states. For instance, states that have adopted Orsenco regulations, like Pennsylvania, limit some mercury discharges into the river, while Illinois does not. Toby Frevert is an Orsenco commissioner from Illinois and chair of its Pollution Control Standards Committee. His state has its own pollution control board, and he says Orsenco has no legal authority.
They don't have the luxury of delegating that off to an interstate commission or anybody else. They have to adopt the regulations that the administrative agency is bound to operate by.
Frevert says states are required to work with the U.S. EPA to meet federal water quality standards, and there's no longer a need for Orsenco as a pollution regulator.
In my opinion, Orsenco is a great organization. I love it. But it was really not designed or staffed to handle regulations in the modern era the way U.S. EPA and the state environmental agencies are.
But one analysis by Orsenco found 188 instances where Orsenco regulates pollution and the U.S. EPA does not or is less stringent. Tom Fitzgerald, the federal commissioner in Kentucky, looks at the current rollback of federal environmental regulations and says states that care about the health of the Ohio River should maintain Orsenco protections.
Even if the Clean Water Act itself is in turmoil, this is not the time to signal a retreat.
Orsenco received well over 5,000 public comments on its proposal, most of them opposed to eliminating the pollution control standards. The commission is scheduled to vote February 14th, but many expect it will be delayed as the board considers revisions. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Most overdose fatalities in Pennsylvania continue to be opioid-related, but deaths from methamphetamine and other stimulants are also on the rise. That's according to new analysis from the University of Minnesota. Yet nationally and locally, the conversation focuses almost exclusively on opioids. 90.5 WESA's Sarah Bowden reports on how a lack of resources affects Pittsburghers who use meth. And a warning, this story discusses sex work and drug use.
Sitting in the conference room of Prevention Point Pittsburgh, Executive Director Aaron Arnold and I page through informational pamphlets on different types of narcotics.
This is our other health tips for speed users pamphlet. And so,
and it has a cheetah on the front.
It has a cheetah on the front, known for their speed, of course.
Speed's another name for methamphetamine. One tip? Try to eat before and after using.
Often hunger is suppressed while using a stimulant, and so you may know that it's been 12 hours since you had a good meal, but you have absolutely no desire to eat.
Arnold would like Prevention Point to do a lot more for meth users than just give out pamphlets. For example, the organization distributes sterile needles, which are mostly used for opioids so people don't contract blood-borne diseases through shared syringes. Arnold says having clean pipes is just as important as clean needles because the heat can blister lips.
It's very possible that you could spread hepatitis C or a bacterial infection if you're passing that pipe around the room.
Arnold says there's neither funding nor public support for this service. Right now, government, healthcare systems, and academia are focused on opioids. For instance, last year, the U.S. Department of Labor issued grants for reemployment services to people with a history of opioid use, but not other drugs.
These days, opioid-related funding seems to be trumping all other funding.
Sheila Vicaria works at the New York City-based Drug Policy Center. She says while all narcotics are stigmatized, individuals who use meth are seen as particularly unsavory. Often, they're depicted as disheveled, with bad skin and teeth.
But I think there's also a unique stigma associated to the behaviors associated with being under the influence of methamphetamine, being overstimulated. Sometimes people who have been using methamphetamine for days are sleep deprived and thereby may see things or hear things that aren't there.
The process of treating substance use disorder, whatever the substance, is the same. Any intervention needs to address a person's physical, mental, and emotional health. But there are differences in how that drug affects a person's life. Lenny Butler is a Hep C outreach coordinator at Central Outreach Wellness Center, located on the north side. He's also recovering from meth use disorder. Like many, Butler started using as a byproduct of sex work, as the drug heightens libido.
There was a clientele that offered me money, more money, to actually do the drugs with them.
A person in recovery from meth often needs to address how they experience and feel about sex, which can be a trigger for relapse. Butler says that's part of the reason he's never attended a Narcotics Anonymous group.
To go and talk about my addiction with people that don't really understand it, that would be a problem for me.
Because alcohol or opioids,
it's a whole other ballgame. Like, we can't sit there and talk about, you know, all the sex we had.
Dr. Stacy Lane, founder of Central Outreach, estimates while about 10% of her patients use opioids, a quarter are actively using meth. Lane says she's frustrated by the general lack of resources for these patients. One example, there aren't any FDA-approved medications to help with meth cravings and withdrawal.
And we can control the opiate addiction with methadone or Suboxone, but the crystal meth, we have very little tools from a medical standpoint to treat the addiction.
DeAndre Hughes also works with Lane as a medical assistant at Central Outreach and has personally experienced the destruction of meth.
It's evil. It took my life away. He killed himself. He lost his mind and killed himself. And the sick part is I still continue to use after.
Hughes says he's looking for a rehab program and is excited to start treatment. I'm Sarah Bowden, 90.5 WESA News.
Stay with us. We'll continue the conversation about a lack of services for people addicted to meth, especially among the LGBTQ community. That's when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As we just heard a couple moments ago in Sarah Bowden's report, when someone is dealing with an opioid addiction, there's often empathy and lots of resources for people able and interested in looking for help. But people addicted to meth don't always get that same understanding, especially among the LGBTQ community. Why the lack of adequate attention and what can be done? Joining us in studio are Jay Yoder, Director of Development at PERSAD Center, Inc., Tommy Brassel is medical assistant at Central Outreach Wellness Center. It's a clinic that specializes in LGBTQIA healthcare. And Sarah Bowden, WESA's health and science reporter. Welcome to you all. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Jay and Tommy, I want to start with you. So why do you think, why don't we see more about the needs of people struggling with meth addiction? Jay, we'll start with you.
Well, I think that partially it's because it is a smaller segment of the population. Obviously, the LGBT population is about 10% of the population. And right now, opioid use is really all over the news for the broader general folks. Mm-hmm. So we have been seeing an increase in Pittsburgh in drug and alcohol calls to our facility. But I also think that Pittsburgh's a little bit behind other major cities in meth use, in the gay male community in particular.
Yeah, follow up, in addressing meth use or in
actually in both. So other large cities have seen surges in meth use over the last 10 years, we've started seeing it at least at PERSAT over the last 3 or 4, and even more so over the last year. So we're behind in both preparedness and a little bit in seeing the use of the drug.
Tommy.
No, yeah, that's absolutely right. So I am a formal crystal meth addict. I'm in recovery now. And I went to rehab about 2 or 3 years ago. And whenever, you know, you go to rehab, everyone kind of wants to know your story. What are you here for? What brings you in? And so I would tell them crystal meth. People would kind of like turn their heads to the side and look at me like, crystal what? Like, And this was only a few years ago. I mean, I think it's just very, very new. And so, like Jay said, like, we're just trying to play catch up on, like, figuring this all out, because it just sort of, like, showed up here and, like, spread like wildfire. And I think everyone's just trying to play catch up on how to treat it and even how to handle it.
So is it a number of the fatalities? I mean, opioid related, as we heard in Sarah's piece, is still the majority of the number of fatal overdoses. Or is it who is suffering from meth addiction?
I think it's a combination.
I would agree.
And I think there are a lot of negative stereotypes already about the LGBT community. And there's a lot of general shame in society about who we love, how we love, who we have sex with, how we have sex. And then when you add crystal meth or you add a drug addiction on top of that, it contributes to negative stereotyping. And people are a little hands up, back away from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we... or as a gay man, like, I know since, God, elementary school, I've been viewed by sort of like my sexuality. I mean, obviously, as an elementary school kid, I didn't even know what my sexuality was, but I was considered a sissy and I was called names. And then when I grew up in high school, I don't know, people just the focus is so strong on like the sexual aspect of my life that like I sort of did the same thing in turn. And when I would do the crystal meth, like, I don't know. It made me, I don't know.
It releases inhibitions.
Right. Go ahead.
And so it can release some of that shame and make it easier to engage in romantic activities.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, is why is meth hitting the LGBTQ community maybe harder than the general population? Is it dealing with these stereotypes?
I mean, I think it is. It's just the sexual aspect of that drug. Like,
okay,
the entire point of crystal meth is, you know, it makes you feel stronger. It makes you feel more powerful. It makes you feel more wanted, and or at least it makes you think that way. And when you're part of a society that has sort of made you feel less than, you know, you kind of start to hide yourself.
Sarah, as we heard in your report a few minutes ago, we heard from Dr. Stacy Lane, founder of Central Outreach Wellness. She estimates 10% of her patients use opioids, but a quarter are actively using meths. Does she know why, the root cause?
I think that some of it is exactly what Jay and Tommy said. There's a stigma that comes with being not straight. And so that's a way of people allowing themselves to understand their sexuality when shame, they've experienced so much shame in their life. And then there also is an element of sex work sometimes, especially I've spoken to a couple people of color who have done sex work, and sometimes what happens is that older white male clients will give the drug to the person that they're buying sex from, and a lot of times that's a person of color. So there's there's also some racial and class dynamics that go in with that. Not exclusively, but that's also part of it.
I'm Kevin Gavin. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about meth addiction, especially as it relates to the LGBTQ community. I wanted to follow up with you, Tommy. What has your experience been as both you mentioned earlier that you were in recovery, but as service provider and as someone who sought those services, can you give us a sense of what your experience has been from both perspectives?
Yeah, so the way that I found or met Dr. Lane was through a client, one of my clients who I did sex work with. saw that I wasn't doing very well. He started to catch on that I had an addiction problem and that I was struggling. And he's like, well, there's this woman I want you to meet. Her name's Dr. Lane. She can help you. I want you to go and see her. So I went in, and within 5 minutes of meeting her, I mean, I knew that this was the doctor for me. I mean, she talked to me like a person. She treated me like a person. She gave me her cell phone number and said to call her day or night if I needed anything or if I was struggling. And then just sort of by accident, I happened to be at an appointment with her, and she got a text message that they needed some help in the clinic, and she happened to be in the room with me. And, like, you know, I like to think that it was God working in my life, and so does she, that she was like, do you want a job? Can, you know, do you, right. I need somebody to sort of come in and help us out here. And I think she does that on purpose. She knows that who can help somebody struggling with addiction and with their sexuality and things like that better than somebody else who's struggling with the same thing. So getting to see it from both sides, I don't know, it's a great reminder of where I came from and where I don't want to go back to. And it's just a great way for me to give back to a community that I'm a part of and to help people that struggle with the same things that I do. And yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just, I could go on and on and on. Right.
Jay Yoder, I wanted to ask you, in development work at PERSED, what have you observed about Pittsburgh's collective ability, maybe I should say inability, to address this surge in meth use?
So what I've seen and what I spoke to my colleagues about and what they have seen is, like Tommy discussed, an increase in need for services. We have seen some conversations are beginning to happen among LGBT organizations and between those organizations and the, you know, legal and public health and justice systems. But, you know, not enough yet. We're really poised at this moment as we see this increasing to look at best practices from other cities, implement them here, and work together to provide the services that our communities need.
Sarah Boone.
Something that I heard over and over again in my reporting is that there is a real need for recovery services, rehab, treatment services that are specifically geared towards the LGBTQ population. And I think Tommy can speak to this, but when you are in rehab, it's or treatment, and a lot of times it's a group setting, it's a very vulnerable situation. Understanding, unpacking the disease of addiction requires an incredible amount of bravery and vulnerability. And that's hard to do when you're in a situation where you are a minority. I think that's something you've experienced, right, Tommy?
No, yeah, absolutely. So I want to start off by saying that I recommend rehab to anybody always if you are struggling with addiction. I don't want to scare anybody away from seeking out treatment or getting help. And I can only speak for myself, but I know I've been to rehab 4 times. This is a battle that I fight every day constantly. And when you send somebody into a place where they don't feel comfortable or they don't feel like they can let their guard down or their walls down, I mean, I can only speak for me, but I feel like the chances of a successful recovery are slim to none. I mean, how am I supposed to open up and share and become vulnerable with a group of people that have sought me out to tear me down and beat me up and persecute me for my entire life? Like, it just, that doesn't make sense in my brain. And then you have places like in California and in Florida that have these rehab services or that have these rehabs that are geared specifically for the LGBTQ community. And we need something like that here so badly in Pittsburgh, because this crystal meth stuff, it is spreading like wildfire. It is not taking us out. Maybe it's not killing us, but it's killing our spirit. It's killing our hope. It's killing our drive. It's making us feel even worse than we already started off feeling. And there's little to no resources to help people that are struggling with that. And that is one of the main things that we want to do at Central Outreach, is it's a place for people to come so that you can feel safe and wanted and loved. And yeah.
Jay. And I would second everything that Tommy just said. And I just want to let folks know that, you know, at PERSED Center, we do provide only outpatient, but we do provide support for people who are in recovery. And if people are struggling at the moment, I am not the best person, but our intake specialist will take that call, will sit with someone, and will use her best recommendation to find a good place for someone. But we have heard stories from clients. You know, we had a client walk in to our services directly from a treatment center because they hadn't been given step-down care, and they told us about discrimination and gay slurs that they'd heard, and they were just desperate, walked straight to PERSAD because they knew we would at least respect their pronouns and respect their identity.
I'm Kevin Gavin. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about meth addiction, especially as it relates to the LGBTQ community. Sarah Bowden, WESA reporter covering this topic. Sarah, from what you learned reporting the story, what did you find out about, does Pittsburgh have an appropriate standard of care?
Standard of care is kind of, I'm not quite sure how you want to define that, but I think like standard of care is, should be the most effective way to treat addiction is to meet the person where they're at and really understand their needs as an individual. And at least with meth and the gay community, it's kind of like this intersection where there aren't resources appropriately geared towards this population, partly because the experience of using methamphetamine is so different from, say, opioids or alcohol. And then also, when you are a sexual minority, like Tommy and Jay were saying, you know, you're dealing with a lot of stigma. And so it's you realize you have this problem and you want to address it, but you're not even getting the services that address the type of addiction you have, nor are you getting the kind of services that are addressing the kinds of needs you have as an individual.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Jay, Tommy, do we as a city know how to help our LGBTQ neighbors working through addiction? Do we know how to do it?
That's a great question. We are coming together. I hope that soon we will all be working together and will know how to do it. But right now, I know, you know, I commend Central Outreach. I know that there are some treatment centers where our intake is comfortable sending our folks. And PERSAD Center is certainly there for folks who are, you know, in the maintenance level of their recovery. But it's something we have to work on. I'm so glad you brought this out to the public because we have to be talking about this. It's a real problem facing our community.
Tommy?
No, absolutely. Yeah. I don't know. I think it's all a learning process for everybody. Like I said before, this is so new to everyone that I think everyone's just trying to play catch up and trying to just figure out how to deal with this. But I think the biggest issue was that nobody was talking about it. It was like this dirty little secret in the gay community that was kind of being swept under the rug. And it needs to be like pulled out from under the rug and put on Front Street and like talked about over and over again until somebody pays attention and starts doing something about it. And Dr. Lane is the first person. And what I call like her army of hope, which is all we would try to offer people at Central Outreach, like she's bringing it out. She's putting it out there. She's bringing it up to everybody. She's making people listen. She's grabbing people and shaking them and saying, like, come on, wake up. Look at what's happening to this community. And she's trying to do something about it. I think she's just the beginning of great things to come.
Okay, in just a couple of sentences, how could services improve? What ideas can we borrow, steal, use from other cities that might be getting it a little better?
So PERSAD Center is available to train providers. We would love to work with local treatment centers to provide LGBT competency training. That's one current idea.
All right, Tommy.
At Central Outreach, you know, all we strive to do is to offer people some hope. We treat the person, not necessarily just the problem. If you're scared, if you need help, come down to Central Outreach. And if we can't help you, we'll find somebody that will.
And Sarah, in your reporting, what have you learned about calls for improvement and even suggestions for improvement?
Well, I do know that there is one organization that is actually looking at creating a meth-specific treatment program, hopefully sometime next year. And I think providers are catching on that meth and hopefully LGBTQ Pittsburghers need these services. I think people are starting to realize.
Jay Yoder is the Director of Development at PERSAD Center Incorporated. Tommy Brassel is Medical Assistant at Central Outreach Wellness Center, a clinic that specializes in LGBTQIA healthcare. And Sarah Bowden is WESA's Health and Science Reporter. Thanks so much to all of you today.
Thank you for having me.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, nearly 30% of Americans have high blood pressure. Not all have it under control. Why are so many blood pressure medications being recalled? How's that affecting patients? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stinelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.